Do you remember in the 2004 Olympics in Athens? During the marathon, a spectator jumped onto the course and shoved this Brazilian runner to the ground. The Brazilian was in the lead by something like 40 seconds. But that unexpected attack so rattled him that he started losing time. So two runners were able to pass him and took the gold and silver away. Now, in the book of Hebrews, the writer compares our life as Jesus' disciples to a race. But it's a funny sort of race. It's not about being the fastest, but more about getting to the finish line and still be standing. And it's not about competing with each other. In fact, we're to help each other to get to the finish line and not leave anyone behind. And the really odd thing, which is what Jesus says in our chapter today, in chapter 16, is that we should be mentally prepared for when someone might jump out in front of us and push us to the ground. This seems to be Jesus' concern as he sat down to the Last Supper with the disciples, that when we get pushed to the ground, we may get so frustrated and so scared that we would just abandon the race. And Jesus sounds a bit parental here. I suppose what he feels is not unlike what parents feel, hoping their kids would turn out all right. I think pastors feel a version of that. When I baptize or marry people, I wonder if they would go the distance. When I hear people say I do on their wedding day, I often wonder if they're really prepared for what they may be saying I do too. I used to know this old pastor and wife from Singapore. Early in the marriage, they lived apart for 12 years when they first got married because he went to Bible school in America. And they carried on this major long-distance relationship because they didn't have the money or airfare to see each other very often. So I met them when they were in their 70s, and they were like the cutest lovebirds. They would hold hands everywhere, and they would whisper things in each other's ear and giggle. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, my uncle has a friend who had cancer, this lady, and the treatment had damaged her kidney. So she got onto the transplant list and had to commute between the Sunshine Coast and a hospital in the city. Around this time, her husband actually left, took up with somebody, and just left her. So one marriage that went the distance, and another one that quit because something leapt in front of them, pushed them over, and they couldn't recover. Because the hardest thing about true love is sticking it out through the rough times. It goes for our relationship with each other, and it's like that in our relationship with God as well, apparently. So John devotes something almost like five chapters of his gospel on Jesus' last word, beginning with the Last Supper and leading to his arrest in the garden. And chapter 16 begins with, "All this I have told you so you would not fall away." Jesus is encouraging them to go the distance, to get to the finish line without quitting. There's a version of the gospel out there that is only about how God makes our life better, how God provides magical solutions to our problems, and things are just always easier because we have God on our side. Is it, though? I have a friend who just lost her dad suddenly to cancer. He fell down the stairs and went to the hospital and didn't go home. A week after the funeral, she went to church and had to sit through a testimony from somebody who says God healed her of cancer. It was a very confusing few minutes for my friend. Both her dad and this lady were good, devout Christians, two very different experiences with God. But you don't really hear TV preachers talk about how following Jesus can be confusing and makes life harder, especially the potential rejection and opposition from other people. This is what Jesus is warning his disciples about. As we try to live for Jesus and carry on where Jesus left off, there will be people who jump up and push us to the ground. And when we get pushed over, we may be tempted to throw in the towel. There was a guy in high school who enjoyed ribbing me for being a Christian. If he sees me across the street when we walk home after school, he would yell at the top of his lungs, "There goes the Christian." I know, it's not persecution. But No teenager needs that kind of extra attention. And every time that happened, I just wanted to sort of hide behind a wall. So here's Jesus wanting to make sure his disciples know what to expect and are not surprised by suffering and opposition. Because following Jesus makes life harder, because there will be opposition, and they will be tempted to abandon ship. This was not welcoming conversation for supper. They were celebrating the Passover, where God rescued the Hebrew slaves from their Egyptian slave masters. It's a story about God helping a bunch of slaves defeat and plunder a world power. This is a story Jewish people anchor their entire ideas about God on, a champion winner God. And I bet at supper, they're picturing a rosy future with their messianic rabbi, kind of like an Exodus 2.0 against the Romans. And after all, they have seen the miracles with their own eyes. They have drunk the wine that Jesus turned from water and ate the magical meal that fed thousands with a few dinner rolls and sardines. But instead of this victory announcement, they get the most depressing talk ever from Jesus. They became so sad that Jesus had to stop because I think, like us, they had misconceptions of what it took to stick with Jesus and what would come at them as they carry out their mission as God's children on earth. Jesus told them what's coming. First, they will be ostracized from community. Now, in John's time, synagogues are actually Jewish community centers all over the empire. I don't know if we can fully grasp what it feels like to be kicked out of these places as an immigrant in a foreign place. I went to a school in Hong Kong that has this impressive global network of alumni associations. Apparently, I have not had to access this, but apparently as an alumnus, I can go anywhere, move anywhere, I just have to call. And somebody who went to that school, I just have to call somebody who went to that school, and there would be brothers who would come around to help us in whatever ways we need. Now, imagine being cut off from that circle. As an ethnic and religious minority living among hostile neighbors. And not just social rejection, Jesus told them they will try and kill you and believe sincerely that they're doing God's work. And oh, by the way, Jesus says, I won't be around to help you. I'm leaving to return to the Father. So we can see, I think, how they got progressively more depressed as dinner went on. In a matter of hours, Jesus himself will be punished and killed for no good reason. And he's warning them that what happens to him will happen to them. Now, I think we should not confuse being persecuted for our faith to us getting a hard time because we're jerks. Persecution, it's about people rejecting Jesus and what he teaches. If someone gives us a hard time because we're not very nice people, that doesn't count as persecution. But precisely the nature of persecution is that we can be the nicest and kindest people, we will still be opposed simply because of our association with Jesus. And our mission, our challenge as Christian, is to persevere in following Jesus, persevere in the last thing Jesus told us to do, regardless of who might push us over and how many times. And this all-important mission that Jesus left for us to do, the thing he's counting on us to keep doing, even under duress, is to bear and dispense spiritual fruit. This conversation began with Jesus washing his disciples' feet, including Judas, who was about to inform on Jesus, and Peter, who was about to deny knowing him. And in the middle, Jesus presents this picture of a fruitful vine, and he tells his disciples to stay committed to him. The way branches stay connected to the tree, because we're the branches on which the Spirit hangs its fruit. And that requires us to stay connected to the tree. We have the same job as the fig tree in my backyard, to let God grow fruit in us. Paul elaborates on fruit, as it was said earlier, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. I don't know why it is that I have in my life, cannot memorize that list. I have to look it up every time. But these are the spirit-cultivated qualities that give off the sweet smell of compassion and mercy to the people we rub shoulders with. Fruit is how we make a difference in the world, how we are a blessing in the world. The early Christians fruited their world by risking their lives to nurse sick neighbors during times of epidemics. They sell their possessions to anyone who have needs access. And they rescued discarded baby girls from the garbage dumps. But instead of being applauded as for their compassion and mercy, they were accused of a crime called hatred of humanity. They were blamed for earthquakes and droughts and volcano eruptions because they refused to take part in pagan rituals and they have offended the Roman gods. Apparently, this happened in Japanese history. There was an emperor in the early 14th century who embraced Christian missionaries and their message. But then there was an earthquake. People died. They blamed it on people turning away from their gods. So foreign religion and Christianity was outlawed. And Christians and missionaries were brutally persecuted unless they renounced their faith. In the Roman Empire, Christians were captured and thrown in jail. They would be given three chances to change religion, to leave Jesus and go back to pagan worship. If they refused, they would have to wrestle a lion. And so this is what Jesus is warning them about, that in the face of a hungry lion, they would be tempted to walk back on their commitment to Jesus. Now, for us in this city, there's not yet anyone making us renounce faith or face death or be cast out of society. But I think what we might be tempted to do in the face of opposition is to stop living a fruitful life. We make our faith into some sort of private beliefs and that have no expression. We give up on being kind and merciful as children of God, and we go back to being wrathful people, as Paul says in Ephesians. Unfortunately, I don't think it's possible to follow Jesus and not cooperate in fruit bearing, because as Jesus says in his vine analogy, fruitless branches get pruned. If not by God, then by our own doing when we decide to abandon the tree. So John 3:16 famously says, whoever believes in Jesus has life. Well, it turns out there are two ways of believing in the world. There's the Greek way of believing and there's the Jewish way of believing. Greek philosophers understand knowledge as something separate from behavior. We can know something to be true and not live like it. So a doctor can know smoking is harmful and continues to smoke. And a Christian can know what Jesus taught and simply hold it in his head. But a Jewish thinker would find this wall between knowing and doing very odd. In Hebrew, the word for truth and faith and faithfulness are all from the same root word. So a Jewish rabbi would say to the smoking doctor, if you smoke, then you must not believe that it is bad for you. And John, a Jewish man, would say to the Christian, if you don't show fruit in your life, then you do not really believe what Jesus tells you. The Christian life is not about knowing and believing in information in our heads. It is transformation of our soul by our friendship with God through trusting in Jesus and surrendering to the Spirit. And if we really believe it, then we cannot help but live in a way that reminds people of Jesus and his way with people. And that will rub some people the wrong way. And this is the challenge, to love like Jesus in an environment that doesn't. So a few weeks ago, I got yelled at in a grocery store. I had returned some milk bottles that apparently the lady manager thought I hadn't washed adequately. It was awful. I felt like a teenager again being reamed out by my mother. And I think some of the other customers and my cashier were all feeling embarrassed for me. And that experience bothered me deeply because I believe myself to be a very responsible person. If you just tell me what I did wrong, I will fix it. I don't need a public humiliation as a motivator. And I don't feel like I deserve being treated like that. So I came home, I fixated on it all afternoon until I realized I was actually having a really tough week. I was watching two of my friends lose a parent, and we were trying to sort out some health concerns about our dad. So that lady was just had just piled on to the pain that I was already carrying. And as I kept playing back those awful minutes in the store, there was at least one version where I yelled back or say something mean back. Then I realized at that moment that sometimes spiritual warfare is about stubbornly sticking with being kind and merciful, even when we're mistreated and to people who mistreat us. And if we lose the warfare, we lose the warfare when we just throw up our hands and decide to just be as mean as everyone else. This is the mission Jesus leaves with us. The last thing Jesus asks of us, to stay fruitful even at the face of opposition. Even when people or circumstances push us to the ground, we pick ourselves up and we get right back to it. And the good news is, if we accept the mission, we have help. Jesus leaves us with his Spirit. Now, in the middle of this chapter, Jesus seems to change the topic. He says the Spirit's main task is to expose the human need for God by convicting the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. The word convict means to convince is true. So Jesus says the Spirit's job is to convince is true that Jesus is God, and it is a mistake to dismiss him as some guy, and his message is some philosophy. The Spirit convinces is true that recovering our relationship with our Creator cannot be achieved by human means. We need Jesus to do what we cannot ourselves. And the Spirit convinces is true that there will be judgment and consequence to the privileged people who misuse power and cause suffering to others. So when I read this, I was a bit puzzled as to why Jesus is giving us the Spirit's job description in the talk about suffering. Then I realized what I think he is saying is that the way we persevere in love and fruit in the face of opposition is precisely what the Spirit needs from us so he can do what he does. That is, our loving and kind response to opposition, our unwavering commitment to mercy and kindness, even when we're pushed over, is how the Spirit shows the truth of Jesus' identity, the human need for salvation, and the human misuse of power. Our perseverance in being fruitful in the face of opposition is how God's Spirit births new life in the world. Jesus says it's necessary suffering. Like a mother's labor pains, it's necessary to birth a baby. You remember those 12 kids and the coach who got rescued from a cave? This is a news article that came out probably a week after. The Thai soccer boys and the coach began the first day back home with their families since they were rescued from a flooded cave with a trip to a Buddhist temple on Thursday to pray for protection from misfortunes. The 11 boys and the coach kneeled and pressed their hands in prayer to the tunes of chanting monks. They were joined by relatives and friends at the temple, which overlooking Myanmar on Thailand's northern border. The remaining member of the wild boar soccer team, Adul Sargon, is not a Buddhist and did not attend the ceremony meant to extend one's life and protect it from danger. The team has already said they would ordain as Buddhist novices to honor a former Thai Navy SEAL diver who died in a cave while making preparations for the rescue. So this reporter who wrote this seems to go out of his way to point out that there was one kid who was different. That one kid who didn't go to the temple is a migrant from Laos. His parents snuck him across the border when he was little and left him in the care of the Baptist minister's family, so he lives in the church. And he was the only one who could speak English, and he talked to the rescuers when they were found. He didn't go to that very public Buddhist ceremony, but instead attended a Thanksgiving service at the Baptist church and gave a testimony of his experience in the cave. And he said in his testimony that he had prayed to God for help in the cave. And his prayer went like this: I'm only a boy. You are Almighty God. You are holy. You are powerful. Right now, I can't do anything. May you protect us. Come and help all 13 of us. You know, you're powerful. I can't do anything. It's a very mature prayer. And I think we would say God heard that prayer and honored it in the most impressive way. Now, Thailand is 95% Buddhist and 1% Christian. When I read this story, I wonder, what was it like when someone suggested the group goes to the Buddhist temple for a purification and gratitude ritual as a very public Buddhist response to being rescued and to honor the one guy who died? And you say, no thanks, I'm not Buddhist. So I've asked a Thai person. He says it's not a big deal because the Thai people believe that probably, they believe all the gods helped, and the Buddhist kids thank their god their way, and the Christian kid thanks his god his way, and it's all good. But it got me thinking, what if that wasn't the case? What is it like to live something as the 1% of a population that believes something other than the 99%? And what does it take to stay the course in living the fruitful life, to stay kind and merciful when everyone else thinks we are making trouble for not worshiping their God and living their way? From the very beginning, following Jesus meant going against the grain. And academics may talk about how we live in a post-Christian era. But I think Jesus is saying Christianity stays alive and relevant as long as there's still people trying to love like Jesus. When no one tries to love like Jesus anymore, then it's truly dead. This month was the 73rd anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan is a very Buddhist and Shinto country. But I was really surprised that when we got to Nagasaki, a lot of the heroes who are remembered for helping the bombing victims were Christian. It turns out when Christianity was outlawed, the Christians kept bearing fruit out of public eye in the catacombs of Nagasaki. So when Christianity was legal again, the church sprung right back into life and was right there to dispense fruit to the neighbors during the worst moment of their lives. I traveled with a guy who was with a group that went to sing in Romania. So he tells me this story where he asks this Romanian Christian how he stays Christian when there's persecution. And he said the guy got very annoyed. And then the guy said, what is it with you Christians from the West who always wonder about persecution? What I want to know, he says, is how you manage to stay faithful when it's so easy for you. It's only easy if we profess Jesus as Lord with only our words and nothing else. But if we cooperate with the Spirit and embrace the fruitful life, sooner or later, something or someone will jump in front of us and push us over. And we will have to somehow pick ourselves up and get back to it. Hopefully, we would have learned to draw on the Spirit's resources to get up. And hopefully, there are people like in this room who will come to give us a boost. Because we have a job to do. The last thing Jesus left with us. We get to play a part in what God is doing in the world. And when we cross the finish line together, Paul says, we get to look forward to seeing God's face beaming at the finish line and tell us, well done. Let me ask you to bow with me. I invite you to take a moment to take a quick inventory of the fruit in your life. Perhaps you've been knocked over and you want to talk to the Spirit about getting back up to go again. Perhaps you want to renew your deep commitment to the fruitful life, to live love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And perhaps we can look forward to talking to God about how God's Spirit will deploy us this week. And listen to this from Hebrews chapter 12. Do you see what this means? All these pioneers who blazed the way, all these veterans cheering us on. It means we better get on with it. Strip down, start running, and never quit. No extra spiritual fat, no parasitic sins. Keep your eyes on Jesus who both began and finished this race we're in. Study how he did it. Because he never lost sight of where he was headed, that exhilarating finish in and with God. He could put up with anything along the way, cross, shame, whatever. And now he's there, in the place of honor right alongside God. When you find yourself flagging in your faith, go over that story again. item by item, that long litany of hostility he plowed through, that will shoot adrenaline into your souls. Amen.